A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that would be through the entirety of A Little Hatred by Joe Abercrombie. And I would also say the other books in the First Law series. Don't come into this episode specifically if you haven't read every subsequent book. I'll be spoiling them all, almost certainly, as a part of the conversation. Beyond that, we are sponsored. This episode is sponsored by Beer is the Mind Killer. You can check them out over on Etsy. Link is all over the place, anywhere where our links are. You can use our code MADNESS to receive 10% off your favorite nerdy merch. He just recently launched a lovely Beer is the Mind Killer shirt. You know, read more sci-fi. It's excellent. Kevin is a great guy. Highly recommend. And you can save a little bit of money using our code. So go check him out. Hey there, this is Cross, and I'm alone, and we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club. And folks, this episode is going to be a little bit different. I decided kind of early on when we were doing these abbreviated episodes that I wanted to do maybe something a little bit different with the wrap-ups this time around. I may still have guests. I may change my mind. This might be a one-off experiment. We'll see. But given sort of our ability to cover this book and sometimes the lack of our ability to get into the in-depth conversations that I really wanted to have about specific moments, I felt like this section was always going to be a great time for us to get into the details one way or another, to kind of talk more deeply or think more deeply about the ideas that Abercrombie is kind of picking at in these books. So with that in mind, our wrap-up is going to be flavored a little bit differently than usual. It's going to be obviously just me talking to you, you know, kind of directly interfacing here. But I basically just have kind of two sort of central things that I'm looking to talk about here and kind of give you my thoughts on. Some of this was born out of, originally I fully intended to just have sort of one central topic, which was sort of we'll get into it specifically, but something's old, something's new, and kind of talking about nostalgia a little bit and how this book kind of separates ourselves from that fantasy. But as I started taking down my notes to kind of read off and talk through one way or another, I stumbled into, as I was beginning to write Clover, I stumbled into this excellent thought, and it turned into a little bit of an essay that I have about Clover specifically. So we're going to do a little bit of that something old, something new, and then I'm going to give you a lot of Clover here specifically because I really hadn't put that much thought to it. And the more that I started, you know, writing and thinking about this, the deeper and further I went in that direction specifically about why I think Clover is such a great and emblematic character that embodies a lot of things with this book in particular, and perhaps maybe a little bit of Joe himself in a way. So we'll get into that more specifically, but there's your little tease for the two little sections here. To give you a heads up, I am having a cocktail. Actually, it's not a cocktail, it's just a beer. I'm just having a Modelo, sipping on something while we're gonna go through this. So very, very casual, very easy is sort of my thought here. And I'm excited to break this down. So without further ado, we'll get into it here. My A Little Hatred thematic discussion. So, to start off here, what's really interesting about A Little Hatred is it is obviously a sequel series. I feel very frequently in sequel series, and even sometimes in legacy books like Jade Legacy, it can be really easy to lose something when you make the move to new characters. You know, you're playing in a pen of nostalgia often, right? You're trapped and you're hemmed in by the world that you've created in a lot of different ways. You can't move nearly as freely as when you're originally writing something because there is all of this weight. There's the weight of history. There's the weight of everything that came before that you either have to represent in the world to make it feel real, but also you don't want to linger on too long so as to make it the sort of fixation of the story, right? And that's one of the big problems that I see often with some of these sequel series is that they can't outgrow the original. Red Rising actually does a pretty good job of this, almost to the point of where I consider it a separate series. A lot of that has to do with POV shifts and other things like that, but that's not a part of this conversation necessarily. So just for another comparison point, since I brought up Jade Legacy within the rest. But yeah, okay, so let's talk about some of those weights that exist in this story. And I'm going to kind of go through them. I'm going to kind of list them all, and then we'll kind of talk through them as I kind of feel, right? So the big and obvious ones are our main POVs that kind of linger over the story, right, one way or another. We have, of course, Jazal, Shivers, Glockta, and the Dogman that are all a big and active part of the story. Some more than others, certainly, but they're all there. We have some of the tertiary characters like Ardy and Finry, and Isern and Therese, you know, that have been there in scenes, but really get fleshed out here. Tunny and a couple of the others that kind of exist on the periphery, right? And so what Joe does really well here is he takes them all into consideration and gives certain ones more time than others. I think in particular, it's important to note that we don't linger too much on our old POVs outside of perhaps Jazal and old Styx himself, Glockta. This is because Glockta and Jazal both play critical and huge parts in the Union, right? They are bigger than life characters that are really intended to be sort of the lens through which the world has changed. The world has industrialized, right? Oh, I'd be remiss also, of course, to not mention Baez and to bring Baez up into this conversation. They are his puppets, right? By and large, as we understand the trilogy before. So with those components kind of pressed aside, we see that there is this massive weight that is already over the series with expectations of these characters and their impacts across them. So how do you take that and bring in something interesting and spin it in a new direction? I think what Joe did here is really smart in using sort of the setting of the standalone books to kind of move us along in the timeline in a convincing enough way to also say, not only are we going to bring back these old point of views and see that the world has, that the people have changed themselves over time and age, but the world has also moved forward. There's a frequent problem in a lot of different fantasy series where it doesn't seem like the world is ever changing or growing in some meaningful way. You know, even sci-fi sequel series often are able to get away with this a little bit because like tech can just kind of hit a wall and it doesn't need to improve past that technology point. It's rare to see someone go in the other direction of we walk into industrialization and we walk through those steps. So it's another thing that I really appreciate about what Joe does here, right? So that's kind of looking at this through the lens of nostalgia. And there actually is a really fun quote near the end of the novel about rose-tinted lenses, right? And it's such a great quote that Stour levies at us. Hold it. I'm finding it here just because I think it makes a particularly great point, more salient for me. So the quote here that Stour gives us, and I'm going to come back to this chapter, obviously, at the end to talk specifically about Clover, but Stour in this moment, he's reflecting on more immediately the Long Eye and his loss in the Circle, right? He says, "There's no rules against shouting, is there?" Stour spoke soft and with a musing sort of look Clover never saw him wear before. "And I reckon she did me a favor. Losing, it made me see things in a new way, like putting a colored glass to your eye and seeing the world in new colors. Or no, like taking one away and seeing the world as it is." And I think that this is such an important, powerful quote, especially through the lens of this entire story, right? This entire story kind of, we have certain expectations as far as it goes, both from Joe, as Joe is set, and also as readers in sort of the world that not only have we come to inhabit in the First Law side of things, but also storyline expectations, right? Arcs to be paid off in the long run, different characters to mean things and for things to set up and say something, right? Or perhaps say nothing. Joe is very good at saying very clearly that nothing's changed. And it's interesting to have this lens of nostalgia literally lifted from one of our characters' eyes, coming to realize that he has to be the change in the world if he wants to see himself make his mark and make his place. And so he does, right? He claims it very suddenly. And I'll talk more about that a little bit later when we get into Clover a little bit more specifically, because Stour and Clover kind of go hand in hand with each other. But yeah, so this old guard, as a part of the story, necessitates the handing off to the new, right? Something new, something old. And so with that in mind, we'll move over to our newer characters here and fixate a little bit that way. Of course, the older ones will come up here. But talking through them, we have the natural inheritors of the story, of whom I would call Rikka, Orso, and Savine. Those three characters are our legacy characters' children, right? Those are the ones that we have the most direct connection with, because Ricca, Dogman, POV in the original, Orso, Jazal's son, POV, and Savine, both Artie and Jazal and Glockta's child. So like those three points are very natural for us. They feel very natural. Those are sort of our like legacy connections. Then we step into a little bit of the more distant connections. And we have, you know, even further away from this, we've got Vic, we've got Clover, and we've got Gunnar Broad, of whom are connected to the results or the events of the first story in some way, or perhaps stories that haven't been told, like in the case of Gunnar Broad. And then there's Leo. And Leo is obviously connected to the original trilogy through his father. I wanted to say Lord Isher. It's Lord Brock. But with Lord Brock, of course, being one of the rebellious lords that was originally trying to take over the monarchy in the original trilogy, thrown out by Baez, persecuted as a treasonous traitor, and otherwise, you know, Leo is then sort of brought back into the fray Brock is brought back into the fray in part because of Herod and Finry and their deal with Baez to secure the governorship and governorness of England and that position as the sort of northern wall for him against anyone else, and especially pressing against the north. So that makes for an interesting, you know, kind of talking point, especially on Leo's side, right? So we've got these three characters that are very clearly and very directly inheritors, and then we have these four or these three that are very clearly not inherited positions, although they occupy similar spaces in some ways. And then there's Leo. And I think Leo is really one of the big change agents of the story in a lot of ways, in ways that it doesn't make it feel like it's similar to anything that came before. We can kind of paint onto each of these characters, especially the people that came before them, right? Savine has the same ruthlessness of her father very intentionally in the case of Glockta. Orso is sort of the lazy rich boy, which is very similar to Jazal, although not to the extent, right? He pushes it further because now he's a princeling. You know, it's a very different kind of stretch. Ricca doesn't exactly fit this mold, although she does have the bit of wisdom, both supernatural and natural in her own right, right? She's a smart, powerful individual woman, very intelligent and led by the incomparable Isserny Fail. So it makes for a really interesting touch point, at the very least, thinking through those three characters, right? And then if we try to fit some of the other characters into the shoes of characters that came before, Vic very clearly evokes Glockta, but with a little bit of the coldness of Logan. And that's kind of an interesting spot to be in, I think. Logan has an indifference to him for a lot of it until other characters begin to warm to him or he warms to them in the original trilogy. Not to say that he isn't initially friendly or like comes off well, but he is skeptical. He's skeptical of Malekith Quai when he meets him for the first time. He's very skeptical of Baez when he meets him for the first time. Jazal, he kind of like sees and he can read right away. And so I think that he is almost immediately a little bit more friendly with him. West kind of similarly, but that was given kind of the circumstances of where they met each other. But so Vic to me kind of has both the coldness and like the precision, obviously the inquisitorness that is necessary for the story that is specific to this world of Glockta, but she doesn't do the same things that he does. She is less of a torturer, although still is a torturer, and more of a spy. The modernization of the Inquisition is one that's turned itself from the CIA level of enforcement in which like breaking knuckles makes the difference, to one in which imprinting yourself and moving in instead and becoming one with sort of different groups is going to be the way, you know, placing yourself in these groups is going to be the way forward. So Vic makes for a very different character in that way than Glockta ever did, in part because Glockta could have never blended in before. But I also think that makes Vic a consummate actor as we consider her character. So an important clarification there. Clover is, and I'm going to get into this way more later, but just to kind of up level, Clover shares the most in common with Dogman, but with the ruthlessness of Logan. And I'll get into that more specifically. So I'm going to leave that one there, but we're going to call him Dogman Logan in that case, as we're kind of talking through these. Broad is most directly Logan and kind of what Logan wanted to be, right? Logan always wanted to return home, although he had no home to return to, in part because of the decisions that he had made. And we're kind of seeing in live time, Gunnar Broad begin to maybe make those decisions that would lead to not having a home to return to, right? So it makes for an interesting comparison of like, well, that was Logan. We get Logan in a flashback in Sharp Ends, but not speaking about that specifically, just looking at the trilogy itself. There is this sort of sense of like wanting to return. What do we do at the end? Well, we grow flowers. We have peace. We set up a farm, grow a garden, right? Which is what Dogman actually ends up doing. And Gunnar Broad kind of feels like he's moving through that step, but he's, you know, just in his 30s or what have you, you know, late 30s or whatever. And so he hasn't quite made it there yet and is finding it instead very easy to fall into old habits, which is exactly what Logan found himself doing as well. Despite his retiring in Red Country and trying to find and make a better life, he couldn't escape the life because he enjoyed it. And Gunnar Broad is of a similar cloth, but not the same. And there's more to come with all of these characters as well. So keep in mind, I'm trying to scope this into a little hatred and sort of the talking points there. But keeping those things in mind, that's kind of where they land. So that leaves us with Leo, right? And Leo is one that does not map outside of maybe West, but I don't think so even. You know, even West might even map better to Broad in a lot of ways than he does to Leo. Although there is that level of uncertainty that West shares that Leo also has, you know, and maybe that's the closest that we do get in terms of a character comparison and where they kind of sit. Pharaoh is nowhere to be found among these characters in terms of like her characterization specifically. But Leo leaves us with an interesting sort of read. He's beginning to play with the idea of rebellion and treason. He's beginning to question a lot of himself in a lot of different ways, right? One of the things that we didn't talk about, in part because, you know, I don't want to highlight these things necessarily, but there is definitely an undertone of his sexuality throughout a lot of this novel and sort of like maybe questioning that in various points and like just being one of the guys and different looks and things like that that are interesting. It's not something that PJ and I touched upon, mostly because, you know, a lot of these things I want PJ to bring up to me in terms of the undercurrents, and I don't want to try to point out to him in case it becomes something that's too apparent. Maybe you caught on to it. Maybe you didn't. You were yelling frustrated at us for not talking about it. We've already recorded a couple of the Trouble with Peace episodes. I promise you we get into it. but yeah, so it's interesting. Leo fits a very different power dynamic. He's I think, the youngest of our cast. If I remember correctly, I'm 95% sure that that's true. If not, him and Rikka about the same age, you know, right there. And so he makes for a very different character wherein he should not be in charge, although he feels like he should. And he represents his dad, Herod, from the Heroes in a great way, but hasn't quite picked up on the mentality that Finri adopted and that she was handed from being Croy's daughter. Right. And that's one of those things that like leaves me kind of scratching my chin with Leo, wishing for more, wishing for better. But that fits right in with the core themes that Joe always hits upon with his characters. Right. So this is all really fun. He's just the only one that doesn't primarily map to any of the other characters. And again, history weighs on these characters, but it doesn't burden them in the same ways. Obviously, there are certain choices that were made and certain things that were done that cannot be escaped or evaded as a part of the story, like Glockta being Old Styx and the Archlector and Jezahl being king until the very end, which, again, I'll talk about when we kind of get into Clover a little bit here. But it leads to a powerful talking point within this to say, I'm saying to say a lot, I'm realizing as I'm recording this on my own. I hope that you guys are able to parse all that I'm saying. All of this to kind of culminate back to the point that in a day and age in which we are living through there being sort of a constant cycle of us being sold nostalgia as an element of all of the stories that we adopt, it's interesting to see Joe necessarily dip his toe back in to have that sort of nostalgia be there, but also to decry it in certain ways, right? To basically take the core of the story and say, hey, I have to recognize these things. And I know that also I can play them for a little bit of brownie points with anyone who's read the series before. But also, we need to step forward into this next generation. We need to leave a lot of that behind, especially because many of these people's stories were told. They are done. They're complete. Jizal can't escape being a puppet. Glockta can't escape what he's known for and who he is. The Dogman is maybe perhaps the one with the most chance for change, but that's because he's being attacked and forced to act and change as a part of this story. And even then, I wouldn't say he changes. He actually operates exactly the same. So, all this to say, they're the walls in which the story is built on. And then the rest of what we're building is we're putting shinglings on the house. We're filling out the inside of this story. And knowing those walls is important. Recognizing that they're walls, though, they do eventually blend in and you start to notice everything else in front of them. And that's why I think that Joe does such a good job. And in addition, he's more than willing to knock out that wall so that you have an open concept kitchen. This metaphor just came to me. I'm so sorry. But he's more than willing to knock out that wall so that you have an open concept kitchen because it's necessary for the story to move forward. And it's necessary also for us to remember that nostalgia can be put into the past and should be put into the past so that we can give these new people the weight that they deserve and the chances that they deserve, which is why ultimately, like, Orso's death at the very end of the story becomes such a tragedy in my mind. It's not only because we want better for Jizal. Jizal deserves it. He got a shoddy attempt at being king, and it seems like in the intervening years, he's done his best to actually do something and to have actually accomplished something as King of the Union. And that's, I think, what makes his end a tragedy, but also necessary. In addition, though, I think the other thing that this says to us, and something that we should keep in mind, is that while this book does something, it does a lot of things very uniquely, but it indulges us in the past, giving us cameos along with our reasons to move forward. And then the last couple of chapters stick a dagger in the heart of our nostalgia. Okay, I have more that I could say about the characters, and I will definitely have more to say with either guests or in future as we kind of move through them. I'm kind of imagining, as I'm beginning to think this through, I probably have an essay on a character in each one of these books that I can think of right now that I'm pretty sure that I could rip, but I want to give you this kind of holistically. So with that, I want to move into sort of what I wanted to talk about with, I got to talk about my favorite character first, my own personal. And this will lead us into Jonas Glover, because I think it does a really great job. But there's a quote in here that we didn't talk about within the episode that I really love as far as it relates to Shivers and his place of wisdom in this story. It's interesting because it's almost, I feel, intended to be a handing off point of wisdom to us, if you're kind of paying attention to the thematic level, as Shivers and Clover kind of have this exchange between the two of them. So Shivers, you know, of course, being a previous POV character, given his place directly next to Rikka in the story, instead of actually being included as a point of view character, I think is an incredible choice. It would have been very easy to take Shivers and to plop him down as the point of view character here instead of giving us Rikka, especially given the visions and everything else. We could have questioned it better even from the outside than from the inside. And that could have led to a very different sort of story in a lot of ways. However, I think it's important that we don't, because I do think that we get more from being on the outside. And it just makes a lot of the punches land all the harder. So that quote, like I was saying, so Clover says, we all play the cards we're dealt. And Shivers replies, some of us do. Some of us kill men with better cards and play theirs instead. And beyond being a great little Abercrombie quote among many that especially are levied within the Jonas Clover chapters, this one strikes me as particularly poignant and is what ultimately kicked off my essay about Clover, because I wanted to include this quote because I know that we missed it and talk about it, because I think that it does such a good job of illustrating, you know, this idea of fairness, right, in the story in a lot of ways, and also belies the point that Shivers recognizes this in Clover, which is unique, and he recognizes it in himself, and he's came to terms with it over the course of time. He's evolved between the pages. He evolved between each of the standalones, sometimes negatively until he kind of turned the positive corner at the end of Red Country to be here now as this character. And one of the unique things about Shivers is, again, he's in nearly every book with the exception of The Blade itself. And so I think that it's just critical to give him the little head nod of, like, kind of the main through line of this thread of the story in a lot of ways. And so I think that when you're reading, if you haven't read the books that follow this, pay attention, pay a little bit more attention to Shivers. Just try to think through why he's saying what he's saying and why he's doing what he's doing and the capacity in which he has had to change. And I think it will give you a lot more hope for the characters in the long run versus the short run that we see them run. Now, this could just be, you know, Shivers. And I think specifically this leads me very well into Clover. I need to talk about Jonas Clover. The man is something else entirely in this story. He is a unique little character. We're introduced to him as he's training children on a sword hill, sitting under a tree, eating an apple before he's approached by Black Calder to become the second to Wonderful, of whom is the second of Stour, Nightfall, his own son and heir to the King of the North. And this leads us down an interesting path, right? I didn't mention Stour as sort of a new character, but obviously he's a new and very important character within the story. But he's sitting there lazily teaching them swordplay. And over the course of this story, we actually come to learn, I think I can make the argument, that there's a good chance that Stour has never been a remarkable swordsman. He's been a remarkable scoundrel. He is much more in common. We're kind of pitched him as sort of like a Logan Nine Fingers type. But instead what he is much more of like a crossbreed between like a Monza and a Black Dao. He's much more ruthless, although presents himself very socially. You know, perhaps even Koska might be a good comparison here as well. The big difference between him and Koska, of course, being that there's a lot more of a sort of, he's lying to himself in addition, but Clover is unwilling to lie to himself a lot of the time. So those are important comparisons, but I think that it kind of gets to the point of who Clover is as a character very early, and we get a sense of who he wants us to believe he is, which is an interesting point to start on, especially given the fact that he is in a unique place as the named man that he is. So I know on the show we pointed out some of the more obvious components of Clover. He's an easy touchstone so that we have a connection to the North, to Stour, you know, something to follow along with there and more. But here he fits right in among the original crew as we might see them in the original trilogy. It isn't until a couple of critical moments that we find out that he's much, much worse. And I mean this from the perspective of he fits in like a gray character, right? He seems to have the same sort of moral bankruptcy, although times of leniency. We can look to him when he let Rika go, when he noticed her when he was peeing. Didn't notice her there when he was chasing her through the woods at Nightfall's request, when they're catching her and she knows the arrow shortly thereafter. Among a number of other moments that come over the course of the story. So there's some like nice little crispy moments, we'll call them, with Clover as we get to know him as a character that shows that he kind of fits in with those characters, right? But it isn't, we really don't learn that he isn't the man that he's presented himself to us until Clover's place in the Battle of Red Hill. And it is perhaps one of the best scenes I've seen depicted on someone skipping out on a battle that they wanted to avoid since Catch 22. It is an incredible depiction of the sort of like irony of war and of fighting and the best way to stay out of it, you know, especially knowing the side that you're on and knowing the sort of like the winning side versus the losing side, understanding that your individual contribution probably doesn't mean that much so long as not everyone behaves this way, and presenting yourself in such a way that it seems as though you are for the cause despite being against it. It's such a subtle betrayal, and it's so, so clever and brilliantly done and rendered. Truly, I recently reread Catch 22, and I've been rewatching the miniseries as well on Hulu. A great little miniseries, by the way. It came out during COVID, and I think it got missed by a lot of people, but it is excellent. Produced by George Clooney, and I think partially written and directed. Excellent, excellent work across the whole board with the whole cast, 6 episodes. Love it. That said, it is such a unique portrayal as he kind of kills the man, right? So, in case you've forgotten, he finds himself accosted by one of Stour's men, and after giving him a couple of vague warnings, kind of guised as his usual wisdom that he provides, he quickly kills him with an arrow, dragging him back to the medical tents for help, even though that he knows that the man is well past saving. It's brilliant. It's stark. It gives us a dividing line in who Jonas Clover is, willing to kill to survive. Importantly, though, And finally, you know, in this kind of mindset, it's impossible to forget his final scene in the novel, confronted by a choice presented by Stauer, in which he doesn't even flinch away for a single second. There isn't an ounce of him that doesn't consider killing Wonderful in his point of view. He just turns and does it before it even registers in his brain, before the sentence clears from Stauer. There is plenty, plenty of regret for him doing it that comes later as a part of the chapter, including needing to lay her down and hold her in those moments. But he's accepted that he's okay with ghosts. He's accepted that he's okay with this ghost of her haunting him and is clearly capable of moving on, considering he's the only character that we know to have attempted to completely separate himself from his named man name of Steepfield, as we come to learn over the course of the story. And this begs the question of who was he before? And we don't get this answer right away. It leaves us to an interesting point. We're conditioned at this point to think a certain way when we read an Abercrombie book, and we very carefully sit and stew for him next to all of this in this novel up until this point with Clover. Yes, he's smart. Yes, he's clever. Yes, he's funny. He's brilliant with loads of wisdom. But the thing about Clover, and one of the insightful things that I found thinking about it here, is that wisdom isn't often practical in any way, shape, or form. That's why Abercrombie has done a great job, I think, especially in the original trilogy, of avoiding, you know, many sort of conventional witticisms and trying to kind of step away from them one way or another, eventually portraying them in other pieces and like in Best of Cold with the sort of philosophers and everyone else that's kind of written and often quoted there. And, you know, obviously there's some insight to be gleaned from life and living it, but he understands that it requires living and acting to do it, right? Or at the very least, the best is that it seems good on paper and it's not good elsewhere. Wisdom also isn't often ruthless like he is, taking lives wantonly, however it fits his survival, right? That's really the deal with Clover. He's willing to do whatever it takes to survive, and that must be based on something in his past. Just before he kills Wonderful in the chapter, My Kind of Bastard, they share an exchange about them working together, training kids in swordsmanship. He says, "You've more wisdom to pass on than most, I reckon." She snorted, "More than you have, that's for sure." He replies, "There you go. Like all good partnerships, we make up for each other's deficiencies. You can do the passing of wisdom, I'll do the sitting in the shade." And this is such an embodiment of who he is as a person, and as I hope that I've built a good image of up until this point. It illustrates, in a lot of ways, his own vile behavior and makes for a great metaphor for his story on the whole. There's potential here for something more, for something new, for something to work. Wonderful does have more wisdom, and as such, much more overall worth to the world, potentially, and what she could teach people, what she could lend, as she's a role model for female warriors the world over, right? As she's something that can be aspired to and that the youth can look to that is a very different cut of the cloth. But ultimately, she's cut down because our guy, Jonas Clover, Jonas Steepfield, is lazy and has instead set himself on the path of least resistance in many ways, the easiest road to his survival, leaving the world that much less wise, removing that grain that could have made a difference for so many people, especially in the North, to not have that anymore. And the worst part about it is, though, is that he knows it. And I believe that he truly believes what he's saying in that moment to her, that she is worth way more to this world than he is. But this is Joe's classical cruelty, right? Is the people that are worth more are the ones of whom get cut down and excised from the world in that way. Yeah, it's so brilliant. I love it. I love this in particular. I love Clover, despite hating him more than most of the characters in this book in particular. In this read through, it was really interesting for this to kind of shape. So, you know, in kind of conclusion here, he's sitting in the shade of his life at the end here, you know, growing fat and trying to rename himself. And he's this shadow trying to distance himself from the name that he carried before. It's one that he wants to forget and wants others to forget. Simultaneously, he can't outrun it. And that's why he's Stauer's kind of bastard. There's a tragedy that belies his particular brand of cowardice. So, moving past Jonas Clover into maybe my summation for the story and for this wrap-up episode, of which I hope you enjoyed, this book does something very unique. Again, to reiterate, It indulges us in the past, gives us cameos along with our reasons to move forward. And then the last couple of chapters stick a dagger in the heart of our nostalgia, proving that we can knock out those walls just as easily. And there are a couple of hints of more deaths on the horizon in the form of bona fide visions from Rikka, from real magic in the world. This first chapter confirms for us, a little hatred, confirms for us in many ways that Joe might still be playing with old toys, but he also confirmed for us what we knew all along. Toys old and new break just the same. Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast of Words and Whiskey. With that in mind, next week we are going to be reading part four, the entirety of part four of A Trouble with Peace. Very excited for this episode. It was a blast to record. I've already recorded it. PJ's already read it. It was a great time. Really hope you enjoy it. Very excited to kind of take that one down a little bit. With that in mind, you can check us out in all the usual social places, like PJ would usually say, u/WordsAndWhiskeyPod on Reddit, WordsAndWhiskeyPod on pretty much every other social that you can find us, including Blue Sky. Just throw wordsandwhiskey.show in there. You can send us an email at wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com. And beyond that, you can give us a phone call or shoot us text messages at 910-408-2534. You should leave us a review on whatever platform that you listen to us through. You can do that. Otherwise, I'm going to send the laziest swordsman bastard after you. Thank you guys so much for listening.